Welcome everyone to Season 3 of the Quaff Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Lee, where I'll be interviewing and talking to Queen's alumni and finance professionals to gain insight on what's made them successful in their career and how they've achieved the success. The Queen's University Alternative Assets Fund, otherwise known as Quaff, is Canada's first student-run alternative fund with over $500,000 of assets under management. Managed exclusively by graduates, faculty, and industry professionals, the fund utilizes both private and public alternative investing strategies. Quaff is designed to provide students with hands-on experience and exposure in the investment, alternative investing, and portfolio management industry. Through engagement of alumni, faculty, current members, and industry professionals, we've established ourselves as an invaluable educational opportunity for Queen's Smith School of Business graduate students. Please note, this podcast is not financial advice and is for general and informational purposes only. Please seek the use of a professional for financial and investing advice. All discussions are opinions of the podcast host and guests and do not reflect those of Quaff, Queen's, Smith School of Business, employers, or related parties. Please enjoy. Welcome everyone to Season 3, Episode 1 of the Queen's University Alternative Asset Fund Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Lee, a recent grad of the 2022 AMBA program, and I'm currently working in risk advisory for Loblaw Companies Limited and in operations at Quaff. Our guest today is one I started out with at Ernst & Young. He currently works for RBC Capital Markets as an analyst in their mergers and acquisitions practice. He's completed the CPA program and is also in the midst of completing the CFA program. He's one of the smartest and funniest people I've worked with, and overall great guy. What can't he do? Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Krojak.
Hey, Nick. Thanks a lot for having me on, man. Really excited to be here. Smartest guy? I don't know, but we'll see.
Well, you know, one thing I learned from you, Sean, I've kind of carried this over. I don't know if this is a... No, I. You know, it's a good thing. But one thing you said to me while we were studying for the CPA program. For those of you who don't know, the CPA program is essentially you have to study for six 2 to 3 month modules. And then the final level is a 3 day exam. But you said to me, because I remember asking you about it, how you were feeling before the exam. And you said, diamonds are made under pressure. So I've kind of carried that mentality with me through work, and generally I actually think it's caused me to procrastinate more. But anyway, I know you're a busy guy, so let's get into it. So Sean, tell the audience about yourself, and maybe I'll just give a bit of background. So like I mentioned before, Sean and I started out at EY as accountants, but now you're at RBC Capital Markets. Could you tell me a little bit more about your current role?
Yeah, absolutely. Starting off a bit about myself, born and raised BC boy, attended UBC, graduated in April 2019. So I'm approaching my 4 year graduation anniversary here. And following graduation, I started an audit at Big Four with Nick here at EY in Vancouver. The goal was always to kind of make an exit into M&A as soon as I obtained my practical experience requirements to designate. And yeah, I was able to exit into capital markets around April 2022. And my current role is a associate on the mid-market M&A team here in Vancouver. We handle strictly sell-side mandates, mid-market transactions ranging from around 15 to 200, 250 million is on the much higher end, doesn't occur that often at those high numbers, but when they do, the team gets excited for sure.
That's awesome. So I totally botched your intro. I called you an analyst, but it looks like you're actually an associate. So I apologize for that, dude. You kind of mentioned that you always, you know, one of your goals was to exit into M&A. What's, you know, for viewers who don't know, what is the difference between working in M&A or, because when people say they work in M&A, I think sometimes people get confused if they're working in investment banking, or could you just go into a little bit more and explain maybe the differences or the intricacies of that?
like the difference between a strict sell side M&A advisor and a traditional investment banker?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I work in the mid market, and we focus on sell side mandates of private companies. So that's one of the biggest difference, working with strictly private companies to start. And then our team focuses strictly on sell side mandates, whereas a traditional global investment banker, we call them at RBC, would work on IPOs, equity financings, debt financings, as well as sell side mandates for large private and public companies. The essence of the work ends up being fairly similar, understanding what makes the business competitive and marketing it to potential equity financiers or buyers.
Awesome. Okay, no, that's definitely more clear. Maybe just rewinding a little bit, what made you want to transition out of accounting and into more of a finance role? Because I know, obviously, with accounting, you're kind of always looking back, you're looking at historical records, but finance is more forward looking. But you personally, what made you want to make that switch?
I mean, it happened pretty early. I was in, I think it was third year uni in Com 370 corporate finance. I think you probably took it too, Nick, through DAP. I think just reading the textbook, learning about synergies, like when two companies come together and they're able to optimize operationally and kind of enhance their operating costs and minimize operating costs, and then in turn increase revenues as well. I just thought that was extremely interesting, and realized right away that I kind of wanted to work in M&A and corporate, or like a corporate development type role, bringing two companies together to create something bigger. And just to speak on the finance point specifically, I mean, accounting is the fundamentals, and it's kind of like your training wheels in finance, I think. So it's fantastic to learn, but at the end of the day, accounting is summarizing past events, whereas a good chunk of finance is forecasting future events and using that for strategic decision making, which kind of I thought was a bit more interesting and dynamic, and thinking outside and required thinking outside the box. So it kind of just interests me a bit more in terms of kind of working in these fundamental accounting rules, whether they be ASPE or IFRS. You're kind of working inside of a box, right?
Right. No, that's definitely very interesting. Actually, maybe going back to something you said before, one thing we do learn a lot about in our MBA classes, you know, strategic transformation, acquisitions, etc. This is part of your day-to-day. What am I trying to say here? I think it's, maybe you've seen it, but in terms of, let's just say, like an acquisition, like, you know, two companies coming together, forming synergies, you know, whether it's like cutting costs or trying to optimize efficiency, there's theory and then there's actual practice. Could you kind of go into more detail with that? I know this is a, you know, kind of an open-ended loaded question, but what have you seen so far? I've always been curious about this.
Yeah, so like there's a few different places where companies can find synergies, right? Like for example, maybe your business is a fantastic manufacturer of your product, but you are currently outsourcing your shipping and logistics to a 3PL provider, being a third-party logistics provider. So then maybe you're looking for a company that operates in a very similar line of business to you, but their operations, they're using a co-packer and co-manufacturer, but like they have their own in-house shipping and logistics. So that right there is your ideal synergy optimization. Like you guys will be able to come together and save a ton of costs in your accounting and finance, and then where it really matters in your manufacturing and then shipping and logistics for both parties involved, right? So it's beneficial for both parties, but they can also occur geographically. So maybe you're manufacturing in the West Coast and you're shipping product to the Southeast United States. You might be better off purchasing a similar company that is manufacturing in Southeast America and then shipping product directly from that manufacturing facility. So there's various different ways. That's two fairly standard ones, but I think that's a good place to start on it.
No, definitely. I think, like I said, I think we learn a lot of theory in class, and really understanding how it works in practice, it's interesting. So thanks for that. But talking about going from EY to RBC, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced making that transition?
I think one of the biggest ones is kind of the shift in mindset. Maybe you agree with me on this, or maybe you disagree, Nick, but I found working in audit sometimes to be the importance to be placed on speed and like getting a product out quickly. That being due to a variety of factors, maybe it was like deal with tight deadlines, tight budgets, and also just the fact that the documents and workbooks that we were preparing remain internal. So I felt like I was just trying to get a product out the door as fast as possible, whereas I find now the products and work that we're taking on and performing on is more so quality based. So we really want to take our time and produce a quality product to send out the door.
Yeah, no,
I think just that shift in mindset, like slowing myself down and like rereading a lot of stuff and proofreading and just understanding that like I can take my time on this and not rush to get out the door is what was kind of one of the biggest shifts for me.
Right. No, absolutely. I think I definitely don't miss the days hammering keys all night, but just trying to produce. I think one of the biggest things I learned was, and I think this does apply to a lot of things, but you know, knowing when good is enough. But I feel like, you know, a lot of us are actually, I think that's something that a lot of us struggle with, because, you know, obviously you want to do a good job, but I think sometimes in audit, you're forced to settle with okay work. But no, I totally know what you mean. So that's pretty interesting. What do the hours look like in your current role?
It's volatile, but I mean, I would say average between 50 and 60 hours a week. Yeah. Oftentimes it can be like 40. Sometimes it's 60 to 70. But I mean, I think it's a lot less busy working in the mid-market than some of the global investment bankers have it. But the hours definitely vary depending on where we're at in the deal process, right? Like when we're in preparation stages, kind of building out marketing materials, it's a little bit slower. But then sometimes when you get into those due diligence portions of the deal where you're kind of discussing with buyers or discussing with third-party accounting firms doing a due diligence report, you're throwing a hot potato back and forth. So like right when it comes in, you got to get it out. So maybe you can be 9 p.m. you're looking to hit the hay, and all of a sudden the email comes through and it's kind of got to be tackled immediately.
Right.
And that's when it gets a tad busier.
Yeah. Got it. You get hit with a please fix and it's, you know, you got to get it done. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just speaking towards more your education, like the CPA program and also the CFA, I know you've completed level one, but in theory, kind of has that helped you with the work you do now?
100%. Yeah. And I mean, our team is pretty focused on hiring CPAs. It's a fantastic building block to move forward into a finance career, especially just understanding the kind of fundamentals of client communication, building an information request list, and then also just being able to comb through data and make it work for you, right? Because a lot of times with these middle market businesses, they're not, they don't have the most sophisticated system. So maybe request like a gross margin report by product, and they're not necessarily able to supply that exactly, but they have a few different reports that might kind of come together, and it's up to you to just make it work. It might not be the perfect fit, but you're going to make the shoe fit.
No, absolutely.
But I think just learning how to comb through large amounts of data, and also working with like trial balances and general ledgers and all of companies' internal schedules, whether they're supporting the balance sheet or income statement, is a great skill to learn early on in your career.
For sure. And for those of you listening that means pay attention in your accounting classes. So yeah.
Bingo.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually important. So make sure you guys are studying up on that. It's funny, you know, I'm talking to you off hours about this, asking you questions about work, and I'm, you know, here I am just drilling down into. I sound like an auditor here, but I know, God, I can't escape it. But would you be able to break down, like, maybe? And I understand, obviously, the work you do is very, it's deal based, different industries, like it varies wild. It could vary wildly, but would you be able to give maybe like a walkthrough on what you walk through? I sound like an accountant, but
on ARAP or
yeah, no, exactly, no revenue, buddy. But but just like maybe walk us through, just because I feel like some of the, you know, viewers, though, for those who are interested in a career in M&A, they might not know exactly what you do. But what are some of the things you look at? Like, what are some of the things you do on a day-to-day basis?
For sure. So what I'll do is try my best to walk you through a deal from like stage one, pitching for the client, to eventually closing the deal.
Right.
So we work on a fee basis. So we're trying to obtain clients to sell their business. And then we charge a transaction fee based on the purchase price of the business when we're eventually able and hopefully able to sell the business for the highest value that we think we can obtain. So that starts off with a pitch process. We'll build out some discussion materials, includes an analysis of the business, and then kind of public company comparables, and then eventually into a valuation overview, which includes three different approaches to valuation. Number one being public company benchmarking, looking at different multiples for similar comparable public companies. And then we'll look at similar transactions in the market. So we'll try and obtain a reasonable multiple based on what has been occurring in the market for similar types of businesses, who's been buying, what they've been buying for. And then eventually we'll build out a discounted cash flow analysis, leveraged buyout analysis, and an equity valuation. Which is going to kind of give us three pillars for multiple for this business, pitch the client, and then hopefully they sign an engagement letter, and then away we go with marketing. So this is when we start collecting information from the client to build out the marketing materials. In investment banking, the marketing materials are called the SIM, a confidential information memorandum. It's usually around 40 or 50 pages on PowerPoint, just kind of outlines the industry the business operates in, the business itself, what makes it competitive. It's just meant to give somebody who has no understanding of this business a complete understanding of the business. So
right.
In order to build these out, you have to essentially become a temporary expert on the business and the industry they operate in. And of course, the business's financials. Like, what supports a lot of the SIM is a fairly robust financial model that includes a forecast and working capital analysis. Just you name it for financial analysis, it's in there.
Yeah, for sure.
And then that goes out to between 100 and 150 buyers, depending on the process. And then we will field questions from interested buyers. And then it'll eventually go down to an exclusive process with a single buyer, where you start entering due diligence. That can take between 60 and 90 days on a good deal. And then hopefully you eventually close and you got a few happy bankers and a happy client.
Wow. No, that's great. Just like, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I didn't know.
Long-winded, I know, but
no, absolutely.
It's an eight to 10 month process. So I tried to give you spark notes.
No, it's perfect. I think, like I said, I just actually hearing about what you do, it's quite interesting. And maybe on top of that, like, have you been able to experience kind of like the full like cycle? For example, like be involved with, you know, preparing some of the marketing materials?
Yeah. So I prepared a few marketing materials. I actually just finished one last week, which was kind of like my second one that I got to lead on. So that was super fun to kind of do from stage one and build it out myself. And then I've been able to do a lot of that, which is great. You kind of get to understand different businesses, different industries. And working in the mid-market, the businesses that you get exposure to are generally fairly diverse. We don't have a specific like mining and metals team. We don't have a specific consumer product team. We just do. We're able to work on deals whatever comes our way because there's just not the quantity of mid-market transactions to segment, right? So yeah, I've worked on a lot of marketing materials. The place that I haven't had a ton of exposure to yet is the due diligence process and exclusivity with the buyer.
Right.
So hoping to see a bit more of that in the next few months.
Right. Do you guys generally get other professional services firms to perform the due diligence process, or I guess does it depend on the deal?
Yeah. So there's two kind of due diligence workflows, I would say. The first being handled by us, which is fielding questions from interested buyers. This gets fairly, this is a pretty large workload because we are working with sometimes unsophisticated operating systems, and we have to answer questions from buyers that we may not have the data to.
Right.
So we are kind of working around data manipulation and making the data work for us in that regard. And they usually really like to dig in. So it's a bit of a heavy lift there. So that's ran by us. And then when you actually enter exclusivity, or maybe this can also happen before that, but you get a Q of E report, a sell side quality of earnings report completed by a accounting firm. So that's just a third party accounting firm performing due diligence on the business. And then that report is able to be distributed to various buyers. And then that third party evidence, as Nick would know. So it's trusted by the buyers.
I know all about that. Do you think in the future you'd want to maybe go and work in the investment banking division? And what do you think the transition would be like? Would you ever want to go and say do that?
I mean, it depends. It's definitely on my mind. I think about it quite a bit. If I was to do that, I would like to do that in a larger city with the more consumer products focused segment of the bank. I think in Vancouver, it's more so focused on mining, forestry, in industries like that. But it is a lot of hours. And there's kind of two streams that you can take if you are looking to exit mid-market M&A, which would be kind of into global investment banking, or you go work in buy side private equity. I think the latter would interest me more moving forward, but we'll see what kind of opportunities are available over the next few years.
Well, I'm sure they'll be ample for you because you're a pretty big stud, buddy. So,
please.
Yeah, I'm also trying to get you exposure on, you know, just completely gas you up. But what advice would you have for those who are thinking of switching their current industry? Maybe just to give listeners some context. And I think maybe most would agree with me, but a lot of the people who do, especially the master's programs, the Master of Finance, MBA, or the MMA Master of Analytics programs, a lot of them are looking to kind of break into, you know, I'm not going to say a lot, but there's definitely a good population of us that are looking to break into finance from, you know, whatever role they're in, whether it's kind of more a back office function, accounting, even kind of like IT data analytics. You're able to do that without the expensive master's program, but maybe what are some of your tips and, you know, useful action items that you'd recommend, you know, from switching an industry or somewhat related industry into finance?
Yeah, I mean, I think luck plays a factor once in a while and just fantastic timing, but in terms of technical and actual putting your head to it, I think having a strong understanding of valuation helps, and accounting plays a huge role. Just kind of understanding how to read financial statements and see what makes a company competitive. But like, aside from all the technical stuff, because that stuff is coachable, that stuff can be learned on job, I think having confidence is important. Like, you need to be able to make decisions and be confident with your decision and not second guess yourself.
Right.
I think having an opinion on stuff is important. I was once told that we pay you to have an opinion, so I appreciate when you speak up, and that spoke to me quite a bit. And also just interpersonal communication abilities is crucial in these client-facing roles. At the end of the day, we're communicating with clients, we're building relationships, and we're helping them move on to the next chapter of their lives, right? A lot of these people we work with are owner, founder, entrepreneurs. This business that we're selling has been part of their life for 20 or 30 years. So I think being able to understand that and just build an actual relationship with these people is crucial as well. I mean, a lot of this technical stuff can be learned on the job, but interpersonal and confidence and stuff like that is pretty important in the role.
Absolutely. I think actually one of my bosses, or one of my ex-bosses in my new role, he actually kind of told me, he's like, look, you just need to know enough. And if you can carry yourself with confidence and you're able to communicate, that's kind of the most important thing. But I actually think, you know, it is definitely talked about in kind of business school, but I feel like it should be emphasized more. It's like, you know, you really have to be able to you know, I don't want to say use people, but like you need to be able to align yourself with people and, you know, find some sort of common ground you're able to talk about, because I find, you know, most kind of interactions, or you could say transactions, could go two ways. It's like, look, you're just here to do a job. But, you know, if you can really align yourself with someone and, you know, their interests, like it goes a long, long way.
Exactly. That's such a good way of putting it. Like alignment is key, right? There's a lot of banks out there and there's a lot of bankers out there who have the ability to build out some great marketing materials and help you exit your business. But working with somebody who you're gonna have a fun time doing it with is why you're gonna take them on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just one more question for you. I know you're a busy guy, might have to go hammer those keys this evening, but
potentially. See what the email says after this.
Yeah, hopefully not on a Monday night, pal. But I, you know, you might have answered it kind of in the last question, but you yourself, you know, working in mid-market, what do you think makes you, like, how would you become more successful in kind of like a mid-market, you know, if you're a mid-market firm, what makes you and what would give you the edge? And I know, you know, going back to what we talked about before, building those connections, you know, that's obviously very important, but what would you say is pretty crucial for a mid-market firm in sell-side M&A to be successful?
It's a good one. I mean, I think having a director with experience, a lot of experience, is really helpful. Somebody who's been through more transactions times four than we've been alive is great, because they know what can go wrong. They know how to negotiate. They know the pain points that can come up, and they know they're connected in their relevant market. So maybe they have great connections with accounting firms. They have great connections with lawyers. Having experience in this industry is paramount. I think being able to communicate about different experiences that you've had to potential clients and why you're able to leverage those past experiences to help them is extremely helpful. And then aside from that, just again, back to the relationship building abilities and communication is also paramount.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, they have a role for this. I know some of the big investment banks and some kind of financial services firms, they hire, I think they're called vice chairs, but essentially they're just hired, you know, they're ex kind of politicians, ex people of power, but essentially they're hired and paid to exercise their connections for the banks. And I think it's, you know, it's quite prominent in the US. So I think maybe that's a good exit opportunity for you.
we'll see. You're right. Like we were even looking to hire a business development vice president, who their role is essentially to go out and try and obtain clients for the team to transact on, help transact on.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine myself doing that, you know, hiring me to,
you would be sweet at it.
Oh, I don't think I wouldn't know, you know, who would I know? I'd call you up. You know what I mean?
you'd be boots on the ground at trade shows, shaking hands, kissing babies, finding clients.
Yeah, I think honestly that's probably the only thing I'm good for. So that's it. Actually, Sean, one more question here for you. In terms of, you know, I'm very familiar with the accounting recruiting process. You know, obviously the firms come to campus, they come to different, you could say, trade shows or kind of industry nights. And that's how they recruit. And there's a pretty formalized process when you go through Big Four accounting recruiting, or even kind of in the mid-sized firms or smaller firms. It's all kind of the same process. With your role, what's or even, you know, M&A, like, what do you know about kind of the recruiting process, and how is that different from the accounting process?
I'm gonna do my best to answer this one. I think I have an answer, but it's not, I'm not that well versed in it. So I mean, traditional, like the GIB team, they have a more traditional approach. Like they'll hire co-ops, summer interns, and then they have a more routine hiring cycle, similar to Big Four. They kind of start recruiting pretty early, and then they bring on their interns, co-ops. Select few or majority of them will end up analysts on the team. For mid-market, RBC at least, and a lot of the other mid-market groups here in Vancouver, it's more so on an as-needed basis. So maybe somebody moves on to a different opportunity. There's now a hole in the business we need to hire. Maybe we're growing. Another director came on. We need another VP and associate. So it's more so as needed. So I would just, if you're looking for an opportunity, just keep your eyes peeled. On LinkedIn, whatever it may be. And then, as to my knowledge, in Toronto, they do hire co-ops on the mid-market team. Their team's a little larger there. I think they have around 15 or 20 on the team. So they do bring on co-ops, interns, and analysts. So you're able to join that team directly out of university and or join temporarily as an intern or a co-op during your studies. So I think that's the bulk of what I know there. Is my brain dumb?
Right. Okay. Would you be able to speak to, I know, and maybe this is more applicable to kind of the investment banking divisions, but I know there's kind of two ways to go on about getting a role doing that. One would be what you kind of just mentioned, the traditional recruiting cycle. You get onboarded as an intern or an analyst, and then you kind of work your way up to an associate. Or you do a graduate degree, generally an MBA. I think there's a lot of memes actually and kind of jokes around MBAs or master's students who kind of catapult into that role without having any of the prior experience and analysts kind of coaching them on it. But do you know if that process is similar or kind of have you been able to kind of see that? Or like I said, I'm not sure if you're able to speak to this, but just want to get thoughts on that.
Entering the industry out of an MBA program.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I would assume it's relatively similar. And do you know what? I have definitely seen a lot of IB roles in the States, New York specifically. I've seen a few where they're hiring specifically MBA graduates. Or interns for the summer. So I think those opportunities are 100% out there, and it's a fairly similar hiring cycle. Some of these banks focus strictly on MBA graduates. So yeah, I didn't do an MBA and I didn't recruit directly into IB. So it's not something I'm that well versed in, but I have seen those opportunities available on LinkedIn before for MBA graduates.
Got it. Well, like I said, I know you're a busy guy. Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Krojak, go give him a follow on LinkedIn, maybe even Instagram. I don't know if he's private. Maybe he's private. Show him some love. And Sean, thanks so much for joining us on season 3, episode 1 of the Queen's University Alternative Asset Fund podcast. We really appreciate it, man.
No, I was happy to be here. Thanks a lot for having me. It's a really good time.
Awesome, buddy. Cheers. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Take care, buddy.